Hello. Okay, hi. How are you? You good? That's good. That's good to hear. I'm glad. Glad to hear you're doing well. We're back. Didn't have a show last week. Sort of did. I mean, I recorded this episode, this interview on Saturday, so the interview portion has been living on YouTube for the last several days, but I just haven't really had time to record the intro and outro, get the audio version up, but here it is. I'm still out here in southern Utah, still shooting the movie. Shoot's going well. We're almost done here in St. George. Then I'll have a couple weeks off. Then I'll be in Moab. And then I think I'll be done. But this has been great. It's been really good. I've been riding my horse. Been riding him hither and thither, up and down, fast and slow, and in between. And it's been going well. I haven't fallen. Haven't gotten hurt. I'm doing well. Okay, it's going well. Everyone's happy. Mom and Dad got to come to set recently, which was nice. It was nice to have them there. You know, my mother used to go to set with me when I was a kid, when I was growing up, doing TV shows and commercials and the occasional movie. And she was always there. And it's been a long time since she's been there. My dad had never, I don't think he's ever been on set with me. So it was nice to have them there. It was cool. They got to meet all the people, see all the things. It was great. It was really nice. I'm excited about this guest on the show today. I found our guest today just scrolling through TikTok, you know, as I'm prone to do, to just look at what's going on, what's happening, and what conversations are taking place. And I found Naomi through these debate videos that she posted. She hosted this debate with Kelly Cadogan. Kelly Cadogan is a trans woman who, as recently as like a year ago, and Naomi says this in the interview, but like as recently as like a year ago, Kelly was posting videos talking about how transitioning younger in life really saved her life. And now, for whatever reason, Kelly Cadogan has built her internet notoriety, or I guess maybe has just made a deal with the devil and has decided to go full on right wing, just full on, you know, kids shouldn't transition, shouldn't be allowed to transition, you know, full on debating against her own interests and debating against you know, gender affirming care and all of this stuff, and basically making the argument that non-binary people aren't valid, which Naomi is. Naomi is a non-binary person who uses she, they pronouns. I just thought that Naomi absolutely mopped the floor with Kelly Cadogan in these debate videos. It wasn't even particularly close at all. If you go to @nominal.naomi on TikTok, you can watch some of these videos. They're fantastic. And she has lots of videos where she debates with people and is very, very good at it. And I reached out to see if she would want to come and talk with me about debating people about trans identities, because I had just finished listening to this J.K. Rowling podcast, and J.K. Rowling was talking about how she hated this idea of no debate, that she felt like there wasn't a debate happening. This is all stuff I'm going to repeat in the interview anyway, so I feel like I'm saying stuff that you're already going to hear me say in just a few minutes. I don't really have an intro segment planned this week. I don't have any like bad take brigade or anything like that. I'm talking at the top of the show because that's what I do, but let's just do it, right? Like, we don't need this segment to be any longer than it needs to be. I want to watch basketball. The Lakers and the Warriors are on right now, and this is a really good series. I'm going to watch this. This is a great conversation. @NominalNaomi. It's Nominal Naomi on YouTube, Nominal.Naomi on Instagram and TikTok. Okay, here we go. Let's get into it. Let's do it. From a makeshift recording studio in a hotel room in St. George, Utah, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my new friend, Nominal Naomi, about debating your identity. All right, what's up, everybody? What's up, YouTube? What's up, everybody on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wherever you are? How's it going? I'm here with a new friend. New friend from the internet. So excited. Naomi, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fantastic. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really glad I could squeeze this in on top of like all my finals week stuff going on. So really happy to be here.
Is that what's going on? Is finals week right now?
Oh, yeah.
What are you in school studying?
So I'm a PhD student studying computer science, which is a bit different than kind of the content I typically produce online. So I'm a well-rounded individual.
Amazing. I didn't know that. That's really cool. What are you hoping to go into with computer science?
I'd like to be a professor. Being like able to actually teach and educate has always been one of my passions. And I study like open source software security. So,
see, that seems to make sense. You seem to approach content creation and what you do online from an educational standpoint, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. No, definitely like becoming like academically literate and able to parse through research papers has definitely helped kind of like with the approach that I take to education and advocacy as well.
Amazing. And I hear that when I watch your videos and see that like you're trying to do it in a way. I had my friend Forrest Valkai on a little while ago, and he does that thing too, where it's like it's very like educational and academic. I feel like I try to be in that same space of like social education, but I come from a more like emotional space. Like I'm more of like I'm more theatrical, and it's just how I am. It's just as like an actor and storyteller, it's like the way that I approach it is less of a, just like here's the building blocks of what we're trying to teach you here. And sometimes I can be less, tactful maybe is the word. I can be a little harsher.
Absolutely. I think it's really kind of like an all of the above phenomenon, where like all these different angles that we approach education and advocacy just makes the whole group stronger, because different types of content are going to appeal to vastly different audiences, and having that further reach, I think, is something that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's good. I think it's good to have different approaches to an argument or a position, which is sort of the idea of this conversation too. The episode is called Debating Your Identity. And I was thinking about this because it's something that I've heard recently that I was sort of surprised the first time I heard it. I heard Glenn Beck say it first. Glenn Beck had this video that was getting passed around on the internet where he was like, you know, in a reasonable society, we would have a debate over this. We would actually like hear the arguments. And we would debate about this for a while. He's like, that's what we would do in a reasonable society. But in this society, we're just told that you have to fall in line or else. And I'm like, and he's talking about gender ideology. And I was like, What the fuck world are you living in? What are you like, where are you that this debate is not happening? I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, the debate is happening everywhere. And it's been happening for a very long time. Like, we've been having the debate. And then the next person I heard say it was I listened to Megan Phelps Roper's podcast, the Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling. I watched Natalie Wynn's video on it, and then I thought, I'm going to go listen to that against my better judgment. Maybe I'll hear some things in some more nuance or something. I just spent a lot of time in my car yelling at the podcast and like getting mad. I will say it felt to me, listening to it in its entirety, like Megan Phelps Roper in her way was trying her best to be impartial. And I think that she believes that she was delivering a product that wasn't taking a position. And I do think that Natalie is uncovering some maybe unconscious or bias that's in there, where it's like you're still and it's like it's just true. It's like the most famous person is still the star of the show, and so Joanne still gets the bulk of the speaking time and the spotlight. You know,
I think it's another thing where, you know, the type of like bigotry that Megan had grown up in was like this very explicit, hateful, in your face style of bigotry, where it becomes a lot more difficult for people that, you know, that's kind of the bigotry that they associate with or that they are aware of, to see more subtle forms of bigotry or to see more subtle forms of just like even implicit bias or discrimination. It can really, like, that can really go under the radar when you're expecting, you know, the image of a bigot to be somebody who's like screaming hate speech right out of their mouth.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of that idea of, and she even, Megan even talks about this in the podcast. She's watched a lot of Natalie's videos, and she talks to Natalie about this, and she talks to Joanne about it, about this concept of direct bigotry versus indirect bigotry. And she says, she's like, yeah, direct bigotry would be like my family. My family would be this sort of this vision of bigotry that's very in your face. It's people with signs outside of people's funerals saying you're burning in hell, you know, just very out loud about hate. Mm-hmm. And then indirect bigotry is people with concerns, people with, I've got some valid concerns that I'd like to discuss with you about this idea of living this way in society and what that could do to children maybe, or what that, you know, this kind of thing where it's like, you're masking, you're not willing to be full chested about the disgust or the distaste that you have for these people. And so you mask it in this concern, this like, I've got some concerns about some vulnerable people who might be affected by this ideology or something like that. And she definitely, you know, definitely does talk about that. So she's aware in some sense. But anyway, I mean, the thing that caught my ear again in this podcast is Joanne says that one of the most authoritarian things about trans activism right now is this idea of no debate. She feels like what she keeps hearing is that no one is willing to have the debate with her, that there's no debate over this, that there will be no debate over whether or not trans identities are valid, or over whether or not trans women are women, trans men are men, non-binary people exist and are valid. There's no debate. And I'm like, again, I'm going like, well then, like, first of all, like, I just think that that's bullshit. I just am like, you're not engaged, then you're not paying attention if that's really your honest position. But I think it's also just bad faith. I think it's disingenuous to say we're not allowed to hear the arguments from both sides when it's just like, hey, just step onto the internet any old day, any time of the day. The conversation is being had. And like you said, it's being had in many different ways. There are people approaching it from a very academic sense. There are people approaching it from trying to tackle it with comedy. There are people trying to tackle it with storytelling. It's being had. The conversation's being had. And what I found you on the internet from your debate with Kelly.
That's how a lot of people found me, for sure.
I think it's great that you got that debate because you rocked it. I think you kind of rocked her shit. And Kelly is such one of a fascinating person, one of those people but you're definitely a person in the trans community, in a marginalized community, in a disenfranchised community, who's engaging in the debate the same way that like Natalie Wynn's not shying away from the debate. Like there are people. So I guess just, what are your thoughts on people saying A, that the debate's not happening, and then B, why are you willing to engage?
Yeah,
those are
some great questions. I think that first off, when we see people making this claim of like there is no debate or people don't want to debate, it's just one of these like unfalsifiable narratives that you can really make about anything, where there are people who are going to dogmatically hold to literally any position, be it their trans advocacy, be it transphobia, be it racism, be it any position, there are going to be people that hold these kind of dogmatic beliefs. And so you can just, you know, snatch up a couple of anecdotes and try to paint whatever narrative you want about people who don't want to debate. But the truth is that, you know, the left especially is no such monolith. And there are tons of different people out there that want to debate these topics, that want to engage in this style of debate. And I mean, if you don't think that there's trans debates happening, you're not looking, because they are all over the internet right now, especially. And I think that with respect to the other question about like why I'm willing to engage in this kind of conversation, I think that once again, it has to go with how we really need this diversity of approaches in order to reach people. I think the debate can be certainly one of these types of platforms where people who are maybe less invested in the topic can now get interested, learn more. And there are some real problems with the debate sphere that I think are totally warranted to bring up, where, you know, debate is not always like the best platform for being the most, you know, point by point education. But I think that debate can be really helpful in planting the kinds of seeds that get people interested in a topic, that get people to look further into things, the kind of things that can really start the process of changing minds. And so you know, I'm somebody that trans advocacy is very near and dear to me. And just seeing how I think that there's been a bit of a gap in the online left's rhetoric surrounding trans people. And I wanted to offer like a trans perspective to try to build some stronger arguments and rhetoric and reach out to people in that way. And it's something that I think that my unique skill set is really well suited for. And so I want to add that, you know, other diverse perspective to our broad collection of tactics in trans advocacy.
Yeah, that's a fantastic answer. And I also want to say, I think it's important to acknowledge this too about the debate, or just the idea of having a debate that, like, and Natalie said this in her video responding to the podcast too. And I think it's an important point to say, like, if there are trans people who don't want to debate the validity of their identity, that's also valid and like and understandable and okay. It makes sense why marginalized people sometimes, and some certain people aren't interested in having a debate with you over whether or not they should be granted dignity and, you know, the benefit of like personhood and just like and basic human rights. You know, so it's like I get why certain people are like, no, I don't want to fucking debate this with you. I don't want to go point by point and try to convince you that you should just treat me like a human being, like you would treat any other human being, and just sort of like accept me as valid. I'm not, in, you know, so I think that that bears stating in this conversation that like that's a valid perspective and an understandable perspective, you know.
But I agree completely there. Yeah, like, yeah. Not everybody is necessarily even equipped to have these kind of conversations, or mm-hmm. or they're not in like an emotional state where it would be beneficial for them to even have those conversations. And so, I think that probably my best prescription on this style of topic is engage responsibly and engage in a way that's going to be healthy for your own mental health. And if that means not debating your right to exist, that is completely valid.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, when Joe Rowling says, I keep hearing this idea, no debate. I'm like, yeah, maybe you have, like you said, Naomi, maybe she can point to some anecdotes where people said, no debate. I'm not trying to debate you on that. I don't want to debate you on this. But I'm like, but the fact that you seem to be at least perennially aware of your opposition's argument means that you have at some point encountered a form of debate. Someone has articulated the position to you at some point. It's not like every time you've asked the question, how come I just need to accept this? People just said, shut up and accept it. Like you're aware of the positions that exist, which mean that like, yeah, maybe somebody told you, somebody who either didn't want to have the debate for their own personal reasons, wasn't equipped to have the debate, like you said, or just didn't feel like in that setting it would be useful for anyone, you know, for either of you. But like to say that because of that, because somebody told me I don't want to debate this with you, nobody's willing to debate it with me, that's you know, that's not, you're not being honest there. You're not being intellectually honest, especially if, I mean, one of the questions that Megan Phelps Roper asks her at the end of the podcast is, she says, she's sort of developed these questions that she's built for herself to test whether or not she's slipping back into old habits and bigotry and things like that. And one of the questions that she asks her is like, that she says she asks herself about things is, am I capable of accurately stating my opposition's argument, or am I simply strawmanning, you know? And Joe Rowling's like, oh, yeah, I think I can accurately state my opposition's argument. And it's actually really funny because she says this repeatedly on the podcast. She's like, well, I am aware of what, she's like, people say I'm not listening, and I am aware of what the opposition argument is. But then many, many, many times over again in the podcast, and this is when I was yelling at my car, she she misrepresents the argument. And I'm like, so either you're knowingly misrepresenting it right there, or you're not aware, or like someone gave you bad information. Like one of the things that she says several times is, she's like, you know, and people are mad at me because I'm just saying that sex is real, and people say that sex is a social construct and that it's a spectrum. And I'm like, homegirl, you're switching the words there. Like it's gender. One of the foundational arguments is that gender and sex are not the same thing, and that gender exists on a spectrum, and that it is a socially constructed idea, and that biological sex and gender are not the same thing. But she's like, and people are mad at me for saying that biological sex is real. And it's like, that's, so you're, So you're either not aware of what the actual argument is, or you straight up are straw manning. You are creating a, yeah. Anyway, I just think it's fascinating. People saying you're not willing to engage in the debate with me. And then it's like, well, then how are you even aware of what you're arguing against? How are you even engaging in the debate? If the other side is just saying, shut up, you know?
No, exactly. I think that perspective definitely demonstrates how J.K. Rowling is like not even fully aware or doesn't have enough like good faith to actually engage in the debate, because it's not saying that like sex is real or that biological sex impacts the ways in which people live their lives or their medical needs. That has been controversial within any trans circle at all. I mean, as a trans person, I'm somebody who I especially understand myself that biological sex is real, and that I myself as a trans person have unique medical needs because of the reality of how being transsexual has shaped and changed aspects of my biological sex. So it's just so disheartening to see that dishonest like bait and switch tactic.
It's really funny too. Lately on Twitter, I've been seeing these takes from TERFs where they're like writing these poems because they're very upset about language, like a person who menstruates or, you know, cervix havers or things like they say some of these phrases where they're like, a doctor called me a cervix haver. I'm like, no, a doctor fucking did not. Like, no, that did not happen at a doctor's office, you know, or something like that. Like, but they'll say things like, I'm not a cervix haver. I'm not a person who menstruates. I'm not a person who gives birth. I'm a woman. And I'm like, I know what you're trying to say there through your TERF lens. I don't think you understand that you're inadvertently making an argument for why trans women are women, that like that identity as your gender is much more complex than your anatomical sex characteristics or like what your anatomical sex means about how your body functions and things like that. Like, you're saying in your poem there that like your womanhood is not simply confined to menstruation or to whether or not you have ovaries or whether or not you have like, you're saying that your womanhood is a bigger concept than that.
Absolutely, you know, like, preach.
Yeah. So like, it's so funny. I see them saying these things. I'm like, do you get that's actually the argument? That's actually the position that you're contending with? And then out of the other side of your mouth, right immediately, you're going, but trans women are confined to their anatomical sex characteristics. That is what defines them. That is actually what makes a trans woman a man, is the fact that she was born with certain anatomical sex characteristics.
Feminist, you know? Use of gender for me, but not for thee.
Yeah. It's wild. It's these bad faith engagement tactics. Cause it's Joe Rowling's portrayal of herself when she's being interviewed by someone in something where it's really glossy and she's got her publicist around it. It's this very like Joan of Arc, like I'm just saying, so I'm just trying to express a valid concern. And anyone listening who is just trying to be open-minded and because this is a very popular podcast right now, and it's kind of concerning me how popular it is. But anyone who's listening, just trying to get the fuller picture, trying to engage in the debate, might listen to that and go like, yeah, she does seem like she's being unfairly mischaracterized. And the way that she characterizes herself is like, I'm literally just asking some simple questions about like, hey, are we keeping young girls safe in women's restrooms if we're allowing any man who says I identify as whatever to cut? Is that? And she's presenting it as this very reasonable question, but like, then you go on Twitter and look at her Twitter account. She's like totally homies with Posey Parker, who's like this massive transphobe who like, oh, there's the kitty.
That's Raymond. He's such a precious boy.
Hi, Raymond. But it's like so much of her behavior online and so much of her behavior around the conversation and how she's engaging with people who are challenging her is so dismissive and like sometimes outright ugly and like and hateful that it's like, no, but that's, you're disingenuously representing why it is people are upset at you. You keep saying people are upset because you're just asking this question, but people are telling you when you ask that question, there are implications in that question. You're implicating trans people, and you're implying that trans people can't be trusted or that trans people are predators. And you're saying, like, I'm just concerned about like men. And it's like, yeah, we know that your chief problem is with cisgender men, and valid, but like you're also implying that there is something unsafe or you know, and yeah, that contributes to. Yeah.
That's her classic bait and switch tactic where it's, you know, she'll make the extremely intense claim or like point to an anecdote of like some trans person just existing and people being upset about it. I know she went on this Twitter tirade just about the fact that there was like a single trans woman that was placed in like a women's prison in the UK and nothing happened. And then like, as soon as she gets criticized for that, she's just going to immediately jump back to, oh, so you like don't care about, you know, like sexual assault in prisons or whatever. It's like, that's not what happened. There was literally nothing that happened with that prisoner. She just existed and she started a controversy with it. So it's always like falling back on like a much easier to defend claim. It's the Mott and Bailey tactic that she constantly employs.
I kept thinking while listening to her that if you literally just swap what she's talking about with like a marginalized community that has characteristics that are undebatably baked into their identity as a person. So it's like people think that they can, it's hard to debate something like the validity of psychologically identifying as something other than what doctors assigned you at birth. You know, people are like, because they can't step into the mindset of like what it feels like to look in the mirror or have people call you a certain pronoun and be like, that doesn't feel right. That's a really hard thing for people to understand, especially if they're cisgender. That experience is really hard for them to get inside of. But something like being born with a certain amount of melanin in your skin, just like being born, like people can see it. It's like, yeah, your skin's just a darker tone, a darker shade. We can all really understand that. It's like, there's nothing that person can do to fix that for you. You're upset about them because their skin is a certain shade and they can't, and you can see that. Whereas people can, in their own minds, try to determine that, like, when you tell them, I promise you, I've never felt comfortable with these pronouns or with this name or in this body. They're just like, well, I can tell myself that you're lying or that you're mistaken or that you're, but I just kept thinking, if you just swap trans people with black people, with like, it's something that's immutable like that, that you cannot, that you can't debate the existence or the validity of that identity.
At least not today.
Right. Yeah. At least not today. But if you just swap it and it's like, so even when she can pull out an anecdote of like, here's this trans woman that went to an all women female prison and she did assault somebody. And she brings up an argument like this in the podcast and she's like, it gives me no pleasure to say this, that she assaulted some women. And I think she uses he pronouns, but she's like in the prison. And I'm like, yeah, but this is like a person saying like, it gives me no pleasure to report this to you, but after we integrated these schools, there was an incident where a black student assaulted a white student. And I hate to report that to you, but it did happen. So we need to keep these white students safe from, you know, and I'm like, even if you can find me an anecdote of that happening, that is not a reason to systematically marginalize this already systematically marginalized group of people, like, you know, and to dehumanize and demonize and villainize. And yeah,
no, absolutely. Like, and I think the other thing that shows like just how disingenuous her concern is that like, if you're actually concerned about like sexual assaults in women's prisons, the number one perpetrators are prison guards, not like other inmates. Like that's what the biggest concern is, if that's what we're actually trying to stop and deal with. But I've never seen her once, you know, advocate for, you know, like prison guard reform, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, cisgender men is like, I just am like, your beef is with cisgender men. And if you could just understand that, if you could just understand that, like, your beef is with your dad, your beef is with your first husband, your beef is like, and valid, like that. And it's a valid beef. Like, you've got valid beef with cisgender men, but like, your beef is not with trans people. As I said earlier, I found you through this fantastic debate you did with Kelly Cadigan. And I, like I said earlier, Kelly's a person who and people like Kelly, the Caitlyn Jenners of the world, the Candace Owenses, the even to a certain extent Ben Shapiro, like being a Jewish man who propagates white supremacy, and like whether or not he believes that he does, and like what's your take on an armchair take on what's going on psychologically with a person who understands the process of transition, who understands gender dysphoria, who understands all of these things, and then comes out to like so vitriolically oppose the cause of trans liberation? And what's your take on what's going on there?
Yeah, there's a lot going on trying to like psychoanalyze Kelly, but I think that it's really important to start just like, it was just like half a year ago. She used to be making videos about how like transitioning as a minor saved her life, and how like, you know, there can absolutely be circumstances where puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones can be life-saving treatment for trans adolescents, including herself. And just seeing the rapid shift in her rhetoric and in her advocacy, I think that there's two main things that were going on. And the first is that it was very clear that like she started consuming a very intensive like alt-right pipeline, where she's mentioned how like her For You feed is like full of detransitioners, and just seeing that all the time is going to reinforce these narratives that are very harmful and don't paint the full picture. You know, like when you focus on the 1% case of detransitioners, you don't see the 99% of trans people who are happy and satisfied with what medical transition or social transition has done for them. And in addition, it seems that her own infertility has been like a cause of a lot of grief and distress for her, where she's somebody that she didn't like bank her sperm before getting bottom surgery. And she seems to have a lot of regrets about that. And as she was kind of going down this alt-right pipeline, she was starting to be like propped up by a lot of very prominent detransitioners, TERF networks, also like just outright grifters like Buck Angel. And I think that this kind of created a sense of community that allowed her to like double down and triple down into that, where it's like, oh, well, at least these people get me. And these days, I think she's just gone full on the grift. Like she knew after the debate that there's no like coming back as a reasonable person. I know nowadays, like she changed her Twitter bio for her pronouns to be pick/me. And like she's fully in on it now.
That's always a funny thing that happens when people like start like kind of like 4chan humor style leaning into the like the edgelord like nature of the like just being like, fine, if that's what you want to call me, then I'll lean into all the way. Like, you're going to call me a pick me, then like I'm going to change. Yeah, you know, but it's that like, it's that leftist meme of like the right has three jokes, you know, and one of their most popular jokes right now is like putting something in their pronouns in their bio as something like fuck/you, or like, you know, like just, and that's the joke is that, you know, and Roseanne Barr saying my pronouns are get a job, like, you know, mm-hmm. just that. And it's like, it's just such a like lame joke.
It's so funny though, because like All three of the jokes all just boil down to, I don't like that people identify as like a gender. Like it's literally all the same joke, even though it's like yeah. phrased in like three different flavors of like the fake pronouns, or like the, did you assume my gender, or like the,
I identify as an attack helicopter.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like it's all the same joke of, I think that gender identity is ridiculous.
Yeah. Right. Right. Even though, and this is one of my favorite parts of the debate currently, is just like the idea that like cisgender people are constantly engaging in gender affirming care all the time. Like cisgender people are always doing things to like feel more like their gender. I know so many cisgender guys who take testosterone. So many. Like I don't, but I have people I'm close to who take testosterone because they feel like it makes them like a healthier, more masculine man. And I'm like, that's gender affirming healthcare right there. But yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. And we can even go to like the more extreme examples. Like, I mean, cis women literally get the exact same types of facial feminization surgery and breast implants that certain trans women get, or like the hair transplant treatments that a lot of cisgender men get. Actually, the big pharmaceutical industry for hair transplants way exceeds the amount of money in the pharmaceutical industry for like transition related healthcare. Like men's hair transplants make up way more money of gender affirming care and procedures than trans procedures do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Totally. I don't think people should be denied the ability to get the cisgender people should be denied the ability to get those procedures if it's going to make them more happy, feel more comfortable, feel more confident, feel, you know, just more at peace with their appearance, with their body, whatever. I think that that's all great. It's just such a, oh God, it's such a frustrating, conversation to keep having with so many people. And again, like that's the other thing about people saying like, you guys won't engage in a debate. You won't have a debate. Like there's no, Glenn Beck, how come we can't have a debate? I'm like, no, we're having a debate. We've been having it. You're just losing. Like you don't have a good position. You don't have good arguments. You have no good arguments. Your argument is just like, I don't believe that. I don't believe that trans people can exist. I don't believe that that's a thing. And then they'll say things like there are two genders. And it's like, so whether or not you believe that there's like a psychological condition of gender dysphoria that people can experience or something, like whether or not, because you've never experienced it. So you think that you've never had a panic attack. So you think that panic attacks are fake, like whatever the fuck, like whether or not you believe me when I tell you about my particular psychological thing that goes on in my head, whether or not you believe me, just scientifically, you're wrong about two things, XX and XY. Like, you're just wrong. You're wrong. You're wrong about that. There are not two ways that human bodies present anatomically or biologically. Like, I mean, there are two, but there's a lot more than two. Like, there's...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, oh my gosh, these types that always think they're like, oh, it's just so simple. Woman is adult, human, female, or whatever. As soon as you ask them to define what female means, oftentimes they won't even be able to provide a definition at all. And when they do, they absolutely exclude so many cisgender women, or sometimes even accidentally stumble into a definition that includes certain transgender women. It's just so like conservatives don't know what a woman is. Like,
or an adult. Yeah. Ask them what's an adult. Oh no, I know what an 18 years old. Oh yeah. Why? Cause we wrote a law that said 18 years old. It's 16 in some countries mm-hmm. it's 16, some cultures it's 13, some cultures it's just whenever you first menstruate or whenever you first start going through puberty. So like, what is an adult, you know, like it, when you try to make it so simple, adult, human, female, there's two things.
The other really funny one is that you can even make some pretty credible challenges to like the human claim, where we constantly gender like non-human characters in media, or we constantly gender like AIs, for example. Like we treat Cortana as a girl, for example. We treat Siri as a girl. Sexy robot 2B from Nier Automata, everybody calls her a girl. Like,
right. Yeah, totally. Yeah. C-3PO and R2-D2 are boys. Mm-hmm. Why?
What? Why are they boys? Their chromosomes, right?
Yeah, it's their chromosomes. Exactly. So, okay. So this debate that you had with Kelly Cadigan, mm-hmm. some people could say, and I get these comments in my videos all the time. I do these videos where I do, you know, like it's scripted debate. It's me and I'm trying to accurately represent the opposition argument as well as I can. I try to mm-hmm. script that part of the video as accurately as I possibly can, but it's me playing both parts and it's scripted. It's not, you know, somebody in the comments just said R2-D2 is too smart and helpful to be a man. burn. But people in my comments of those videos, some people in the comments will say that I'm straw manning and stuff like that, or just that I'm winning a debate with myself. But a lot of people who are fans will say stuff like, I love these videos, but like, you know that it doesn't do anything. Like, you're not actually accomplishing anything. The people who need to hear it won't hear it. You're not moving the needle in any way. And some people could say that, like, I found your videos of your debate with Kelly to be very beneficial because I think that, like, you're so clearly in command of the conversation and, like, so clearly, like, not losing the argument. But people could look at that and say, you didn't change her mind. You didn't win because she didn't concede anything, and she hasn't walked back any of her rhetoric, and she hasn't slowed down. So you didn't accomplish the task. What would you say
do you, I wonder if you get comments from people like that, and like, what do you, yeah. what is your thought on people who feel like the debate's not worthwhile if you don't convince the other person?
Yeah, no, as somebody that does debates, like I get this criticism all the time, and there's a couple, like couple points to consider. One is like, first off, just challenging the credibility of the opponent. I know that as a result of the debate I did with Kelly on TikTok, she lost tens of thousands of followers on TikTok immediately following the debate. And people were just like dogpiling her in her own TikTok comment section because of that. Like, she absolutely demolished her credibility because of that. And the other thing is that when you're debating somebody who is bad faith, you're not going to be changing their mind. However, they have an entire audience of people, and that entire audience definitely contains some people who approach the conversation in good faith and are potentially reachable. And so in that conversation, once it became pretty abundantly clear that Kelly was not intending to engage in good faith, my rhetorical goal shifted to changing the minds of her audience and trying to, you know, plant those seeds that are going to get them curious, that are going to get them to think about these topics on a deeper level, that are going to get them, you know, to look at the kind of research that I compile into this master doc that I publish. And that can be a very effective tactic. And I've had so many people that have reached out to me that have said things specifically about how my content has either helped them challenge some of their past beliefs, has helped them educate themselves, learn more, or has helped them even get into these kind of arguments with their friends, their family, their relatives. And so, you know, it does have a much wider impact than just the person you're debating themselves. And that's honestly an even bigger impact, because Kelly's audience is, you know, it was like 800,000 on TikTok. That's way more than one Kelly herself.
Yeah, that's, yep. And that's exactly, that's why I do it as well. It's just, it's not necessarily for, if I'm making a video responding to Glenn Beck, I'm not trying to reach Glenn Beck, but I'm trying to reach anyone who maybe thinks that Glenn Beck is a guy with a lot of smart things to say. And even on Twitter, sometimes it's like, I'm hoping when I quote tweet Tim Pool or, you know, Matt Walsh or Ben Shapiro, it's like, I'm just hoping that like somebody can see how like flimsy the position that they're putting out is, like how just that it's like, do you see how bad this is, how easily in like two sentences I can take this apart? Do you see how easy that is to do? And then maybe you'll get curious about that. And I do tell people in my comments all the time. In fact, I made a video about this recently where I was like, I get comments all the time from people saying, I love your videos, but you're wasting your breath. You're wasting your time. People don't listen. And I'm like, I wouldn't keep doing this if I didn't also get messages from people who say you really helped.
Yeah.
You really helped me with that. I was stuck on that. I didn't really know where I stood. And you presented some arguments in a way that I hadn't heard before. And I think that's the importance of having the debate happening in different ways and from different voices and from different perspectives, is like tackling it from different angles and just trying to, it's tedious work. It can be, you know, it can be just, there are times where you just feel like, God, I feel like I've said this so many times. I feel like I've said this same thing so many times, but there's always someone who it's their first time hearing it, you know,
and absolutely,
it's their first time coming to it. It's maybe the way that you phrase it, it's the first time that they're like, oh shit, you know, I hadn't thought of it like that. You mentioned earlier that some aspects of the way that maybe even leftists or people on the left are handling the debate sphere, you find maybe need improvement, which I think is also, it's healthy to be looking at your own side and the way that people are handling the debate and, yeah, and be able to go, yeah, that's not really useful. There's been some things that have been coming up for me lately. And I wonder if you have some examples too, of things like, people in my comments will pop in and say things like, also like, surgery is never done to kids who are 18 and under. And I'm like, don't say stuff like that. Because when you say that, and I know what you mean is like, you mean it's incredibly rare. It's so rare that it's almost statistically like never. But I'm like, but when you say that, you're just opening yourself up to be karate chopped right in the throat by someone going like, I got an example right here of someone 18 and under receiving surgery or under 18 getting surgery. And it's like, it also we don't need that argument. We don't need to say like it never happens. It's a much stronger argument to say like it's rare, but when it does happen, it's usually because the family and the healthcare team have decided that like it's going to be a potentially life-saving intervention. It's going to like massively improve that person's quality of life. I honestly hope that we can get to a point where we can just say, like, does it need to be that, like, suicide is imminent for us to just be able to, like, help this person transition younger so that they can just live the way that they want to live from an earlier point and just have, like, a, you know, like, I don't know, but I there are when, so when I hear people, the detractors on the other side contending with what they think is a steel man version of the opposition argument. And sometimes they're saying things like J.K. Rowling in this podcast said that she heard an argument that she goes, people will say that, like, oh, this thing that you're afraid of men assaulting women and women only spaces, it's a fantasy. It doesn't happen. And then she can go and pull examples of it happening. I'm like, I do know that people have made that argument. I've seen people make that argument, like, this doesn't happen. And I'm like, it's not that it doesn't happen. It's just that it's not happening in the way that she's talking about it happening, and in statistically high enough numbers for it to be like this crazy epidemic that she's afraid of. And it's not a good enough reason to continue marginalizing people. Like, there are better ways to approach that issue than saying this isn't a thing that happens, because you just open yourself up to that counterattack. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. No, it's also like when people are so worried about like assaults in bathrooms, for example, that's already illegal. So it's like, what do you want to be done, like, on top of that? Like, if this is already a crime, and the examples that they cite of this happening are extremely rare cases that people are already being arrested and charged for, like, that sounds like we dealt with the extremely rare criminal. That sounds like the justice system is working as intended. Like, what are they going to do to stop that from happening? Because, like, a law that says no men allowed clearly wasn't enough to stop that man from going there in the first place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Natalie made a similar point when she was asked a similar question on that podcast, but she said, she was like, so there's apparently like a card that you can get in the UK that, like, is like a certificate of, like, the validity of your trans identity, I guess that they have. But Natalie was like, but you don't have to present that card to someone going into the restroom.
Exactly.
And that was Joanne's thing, is Joanne was like, well, if anyone can just go get this card, they can just go get this thing from the government, then they can go in any space that they want. It's like, yeah, but do you know how bathrooms work? Like, you don't present, like, a gender card to someone to get into the bathroom. Like
J.K. Rowling, when's the last time you had to present your ID to go to a women's bathroom?
Like, yeah, that's not, what are you talking about? Like, that's not how that works. And the bottom line is, like, the overwhelming majority of trans people, when they go to the restroom, are going in there to go pee or poo. That's what they're doing because that's what people do in the bathroom. And, like, that's what's happening in there. But I guess so. Are there any tactics or arguments that you're seeing from the left that you wish people would retire or stop using, or things that you're like, I wish we wouldn't use that tactic because it hurts? Is there anything like that that you see that you feel like?
It's a really good question. I definitely agree with you that, like, the whole point of, like, this doesn't happen is just not a very strong argument, because you're just asking for people to show you an anecdote and prove you wrong, when what you want to show is that, like, this thing is either extremely rare, or, like, you can often challenge these, like, actually at the empirical level and demonstrate, well, actually, you know, for example, the surgeries that are performed on trans minors are exceptionally rare and they're shown to be beneficial. And I think that there's a lot of, like, amazing analogies that we can draw to those cases that people just aren't really aware of. Like, for example, one of the most common gender-affirming procedures that is performed across the board, it doesn't happen for trans people. It happens for intersex men receiving literally the same types of top surgery that trans men receive. And intersex men with gynecomastia that grow boobies can get them removed at about the age 14, 15, 16. And literally nobody bats an eye at this. I think that that's, like, a really good argument where if people are like, okay, so it's okay for an intersex man who has boobies, who doesn't want his boobies, to get them removed. How is a trans man different? Like.
Right. Exactly. Well, I think this goes into, like, how many people seem to be unaware of the existence of intersex
also
people.
True.
Yeah. Of just, like, that they're like, what do you mean intersex? And it's like, just the, again, you think that anatomically, biologically, there are two breakdowns of how bodies come out of the womb. And again, this is a thing where I'm like, you're just not thinking hard enough about this if you're being serious about this position. If you're being serious that you think that there are only two, you're not thinking hard enough about it, because people are born with all, people are born with like three fingers sometimes. Like people are like, mm-hmm. people are born with different conditions. There are different ways that human beings get baked up and cooked in the oven of utero. Like we come out in lots of different ways. We don't just come out two different ways. And so, yeah, I think that that whole thing is just a lot of people not being aware of intersex people existing at all. I also wonder if some of the people who are parroting in comment sections and stuff, it's saying like, this doesn't happen. I wonder if there's a feedback loop of like listening to transphobes and detractors say stuff like, oh, well, people say this doesn't happen. I wonder if somehow that idea gets put into the ether that like, this doesn't happen, or that you couldn't find me a case of a trans woman assaulting somebody. It's never happened. Like, I wonder if somehow just that the idea of that argument being put out there creates a feedback loop where then people do in earnest make the argument later. And it's all just like, no one who's actually taking the debate seriously is making those arguments, but people who are just sort of like getting little bits and pieces of the conversation. And maybe this speaks to what you said, where just some people aren't equipped to have the debate.
Yeah. It's very frustrating. I think that when people start saying things like that, it's one of those scenarios where like, you just can't tell if it's a psyop or not. Like we know that 4chan, like trolls on 4chan intentionally create like Twitter accounts that they'll put on like the anime trans profile pic and just say the most unhinged stuff to try to like make trans people look crazy. Mm-hmm. But there are people out there that are wanting to have, you know, actual conversations and actually engage with the topics at hand. And it's just so frustrating to see like people, you know, push forth these kind of like bad faith arguments or just extremely like misguided arguments that aren't really going to lead anywhere productive.
Speaking of people being maybe not aware that intersex people exist, mm-hmm. you're non-binary, and yes. and this is another thing that I think some people are like, okay, fine, I can wrap my brain around man to woman, woman to man, like that you just go across the, it fits inside of the binary more or less, as I understand it, mm-hmm. that you can go. There are people, and I don't know if it's just grammatically that people can't get down with it, that they just have a hard time with they, them pronouns or things like that. You use she, they, mm-hmm. But what is your experience as a non-binary person? How do you communicate what the experience of being non-binary is? What's a way to just help people who maybe have a hard time wrapping their brain around where that fits?
Yeah, totally. I think that kind of the best way to start is like with clearly distinguishing sex versus gender. And I know that like we often conflate sex and gender just as a culture, as a society broadly. But if you think about like all of the differences that exist between men and women and or males and females, and now let's think about, okay, which of these can we explain fully by biology? The extent to which biology's explanatory power is limited, whatever is left over, that has to be social, cultural, psychological, gender. And once we start thinking about this part that can't be explained strictly by biology, different types of like behaviors or mannerisms or personal aspirations, or just the way you view yourself, it's very clear that this is in no way going to fit into a neat and clean binary framework. Mm-hmm. And so some people, they themselves might try to, they might fit into something that's, you know, roughly along the gender binary and they see themselves that way. And that's great. Other people might, you know, challenge that system from within, being gender nonconforming, and others wish to exist by defining themselves outside of that traditional gender binary in terms of how they view themselves as a person. And that last category would be non-binary people. And I just think it's awesome that, you know, nowadays we're starting to increasingly recognize this phenomenon of third or other gender identities, which has existed throughout so many human societies and cultures for as long as humans have been alive. We can point to numerous examples, including like the Hijra people of India or various two-spirit populations of Native American tribes, the Mahu of the Native Hawaiian Islanders, and even like the Judaic interpretation of gender, like the one that's described in the Talmud, legally and socially recognizes six different genders, which is fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Absolutely. That's a fantastic answer. That's spot on. That's that academic prowess for you right there. Excellent way to describe that. Kelly made a video that I saw.
My favorite.
Where she was talking about how non-binary people offend her as a trans person because she had to go through all of this hardship to sort of earn her identity and all these different things that she had to go through, HRT and surgeries and things like that. Not that non-binary people don't also elect to go through surgeries and have HRT in certain situations. But she basically said that she felt like a person just waking up one day and going, you know what? I'm going to be in between now. It felt like a slap in the face to anybody who's had to really struggle to get to where they're at, where they're comfortable with themselves. And I wonder what you say to that, to people who feel like a certain level of suffering is required before you get to rightfully claim your place in a marginalized community. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different ways that we can really attack that. And first off is that, you know, the trans experience does not need to be defined by suffering. There are plenty of trans people out there who they just experience their gender as a sense of euphoria, as a sense of joy. We can certainly point to examples of trans people where it's like they were just able to safely come out as trans, live a happy, healthy life, and it's just been an all around awesome experience of self-actualization for them. And if you're the other thing is that just like the existence of a non-binary person and whatever struggles they may or may not have doesn't take anything away from you as like a trans person. Everybody has different struggles. Everybody has different things that they face, different forms of marginalization. And that just doesn't take away from the ones that you face just because somebody else may or may not experience them. And if you want to talk about marginalizations along the lines of gender, non-binary people share in a lot of those with binary trans people. You know, this expectation that because you were born with a penis or because you were born with a vagina, you should act a certain way, behave a certain way, dress a certain way, express yourself a certain way, that harms binary trans people, also harms non-binary people. We are both marginalized by the same system, which tells us that we have to be a certain way based off of what body parts we were born with. And non-binary people and trans people can make wonderful allies in this fight in you know, tackling these harmful expectations, these harmful double standards that hurt us all. And that's not to say that like we can't talk about, you know, differences in experiences between, say, like a non-binary person whose transition is just social in nature versus like a trans person who also medically transitions. I'm a big proponent of bringing back the term transsexual specifically so that we can talk about kind of, you know, in the same way that we recognize the difference between sex and gender, we can recognize the difference between transsexual and transgender. And they largely overlap, which is fine and dandy, but it's particularly useful if you want to talk about what some of those unique experiences are, if you want to talk about what some of your unique medical needs might be based off of how hormones have changed certain aspects of your biology. So that doesn't take away anything from a trans person's existence. And if you want to talk about, you know, issues which are unique to transsexual people, you can talk about those. And there are also plenty of non-binary transsexuals like myself.
Yeah, that's great. When you boil it down like that, just that when you really strip it back and it's like what you're saying when you're making a binary argument for the gender binary, that, and this is this immutable thing about society, is what you are saying is that people are expected to fit into a behavioral box that like you need to behave and want and act a certain want certain things for your life and act a certain way and fulfill a certain role in society based on just certain anatomical characteristics that you might have at birth. And nobody actually even knows what's actually going on in your biology. They literally just get a look at your genitalia between your legs, mm-hmm. and they make a determination right then and there.
most intersex people don't even know that they're intersex because, you know, the typical assignment of a sex at birth is just based off of a quick check of the genitals and that's that. I think the statistics we have show that it's like 75% of intersex people don't even know that they're intersex.
That makes sense because we're literally just taking a quick look at external presenting sex characteristics. And it's like, and there are people who are born with external facing sex characteristics, but like internally, it's like, oh, you've got like ovaries in there. Like you got like a penis and like you got, you know, like that happens. And so
surprise. Yeah.
But they wouldn't be able to see that by taking a quick look, you know, so that makes sense. But it really is when you boil it down to that, it's like, it sounds so silly to just say, you now have to live your life in this certain way, and we won't accept anything else other than falling in. And it's interesting that people, that the detractors say that like what leftists are asking for and what trans activists are asking for is for everyone to just fall in line. You better just get in line. And it's like, no, that's literally what you're asking for. You're just saying like, fall in, like do the thing that we say you're supposed to do based on what we assigned you at birth. And that's so wild. But that's – so it's interesting because the argument that Kelly's making there saying like I had to earn this identity is the same argument that so many trans-exclusionary radical feminists make where they say like you didn't go through the same feminine experience that I went through. You did not – you don't know what it's like to – have your first period at school and like run to the bathroom and like stuff toilet paper down your underwear. Like you didn't experience that. You don't know what you didn't experience the male gaze the same way that I experienced it growing up. And so people are sort of like gatekeeping this identity based off of how much they had to suffer to earn it, if that makes sense. Like, or like which experience points they got. And again, it's sort of like, turning the identity into this monolith, and it's counterproductive to what they actually feel about their identity, which is my identity is multifaceted and complex. And you hear this with a lot of people when you actually ask them about like, what does it mean to you to be a woman? Or they'll give you this very multifaceted, beautiful, complex, layered definition. But then they'll say like, but you can't be in on this unless you've met this criteria. And it's sort of this weird, rigid, arbitrary almost criteria because no two people have actually had identical experiences.
What you'll find is that the people that request such a strict adherence to some of those criteria is that the criteria they select are the criteria that they faced. And so, you know, somebody who had a very, very horrible experience, say like getting their first period at school, that's going to be like a really big thing, which is, you know, something that marks like womanhood to them. But there are plenty of women out there that didn't have that experience, and including lots of cisgender women. There are cisgender women, intersex women who don't even get periods, by the way. And so, you know, are we going to gatekeep their womanhood just because they had a different experience than you? At that point, that becomes like a selfish definition of womanhood.
Absolutely. You know, it really breaks down once you get into it and go like, anytime you try to box in who gets to identify as this cultural thing, this social thing, this socially decided thing, anytime you try to box it in, it gets real dicey real quick because I can always find an exception on your, I can always find a cisgender exception to whatever box you're trying to create.
And there's a long history of this being used for very yikesy purposes. Like when the first wave feminist movement tried to exclude Black women from the ranks of womanhood, or when the second wave feminist movement tried to exclude lesbian women from the ranks of womanhood. And you see a lot of these exact same critiques that they levy against, you know, trans women of like not having the same experience of them, of having like a male privilege. That was levied against like lesbians during the second wave, like relentlessly, or that they were invading women's spaces, that they were predatory towards women. This modern day transphobia is just lots of different forms of recycled bigotry that have existed for a long time.
Yeah, Carly in the comments just said, it reminds me of adult parents saying child-free adult people can't complain about being tired or stressed because their experience must be the only valid one. False social expectations. And I think that's a great, yeah, like just when people are like, you don't know what it's like to be tired. And it's like, I can still be tired. I can still have my own things. Like I always just say that to people when people are, that's the simplest response I can think of when people are like, But that woman, that trans woman, just calling herself a woman, she hasn't had the same experience as me. And I'm like, and you haven't had the same experience as her. So by your definition, by saying like, she can only be a woman if she's had the same experience as me, she could say the exact same thing to you. If that's how it works, if that's how the rules work, she could just go, well, you haven't had the same experiences as me, so you're not a woman. And it would be, and that would be ridiculous. That would be absurd, but that's what you're doing. And yeah, this is why I think it's important to have this debate, but also it's very frustrating and tedious, and why I get why so many people opt out too, is because I genuinely feel like the debate is being had and it's being won handily by our side. Every single argument that I try to engage with from the opposition, and I try to be genuinely curious about and really try to give the benefit of the doubt and give its time to breathe and to like sit in my mind to think, like many of them are so bad that they don't last long. But anytime I even try to, it's just like, there's nothing really there. There's nothing really there for me to like actually chew on or go like,
yeah, and
oh geez, you got me, you know?
We're at a point where like once Gen Z becomes, you know, like the dominant generation in power, it's going to be over for the transphobes for at least the most part. Gen Z is profoundly trans positive, far more so than any generation yet. And when we see like the backlash against trans people, it's mostly the old dinosaurs in Congress who are passing these anti-trans legislations simply because Gen Z is so trans positive and so trans accepting and so welcoming all their trans brothers and sisters and siblings.
Well, and that's, I mean, this is the thing that happens in that podcast of Megan Roper's too, that I was yelling at the podcast when this was happening. Cause at one point she interviews a trans woman who's a doctor, who is another one of these people with concerns, with valid concerns. And it was this trans woman who was like, look, I've been helping people and minors and trans people for my whole career with transition and with, you know, different aspects of transition in their, in their identity. And her big concern was she couldn't account for it, the uptick in the increase in the cases that she's seeing, particularly with minors. And she was so concerned. Mm-hmm. And that was what Joel Rowling was concerned with too, and they kept saying like, it's an increase that can't be accounted for. It's an increase that you can't make sense of. And I just was like, this is the easiest thing to understand of all. Like, I can't believe that you're making this such a like, what could possibly explain this like 1,000% increase in people identifying in some sort of gender nonconforming way? And it's like, this is not a hard thing to solve. And I couldn't believe that like a trans woman who was a doctor was like, I can't account for this increase. And it's like, is it really that hard to wrap your brain around? Like if society makes it safer and like more accepting for people to explore with their gender, you're going to naturally see an increase in people taking on that exploration. Like, is that really?
Doctors in the 1940s and 60s just could not explain this rapid increase in left-handed people when we stopped demonizing their existence. Amazing.
That's the perfect example. The left-handedness argument is like, that's the argument right there. Is just like, we literally used to demonize people for being left-handed. And then when we were like, oh, that's silly, we shouldn't do that, lots of people were like, oh, great, thank you, I'm left-handed, I would love to just be left-handed if that's okay.
Yeah.
And they still live in a world where they're like, it's still kind of hard. Like most things are still made for right-handed people, but like, thanks for not like demonizing me for it. I love that too, when people are like, it's so trendy to be trans. And I'm like, no, it's still like not easy for trans kids to come out in many places in America. Like there's still lots of trans kids who like live in a state where like a majority of their classmates even might be really hard on them as they like go through. It's still not like super cool and easy. The same way that it's like, it's still not super easy to be left-handed in society. We still make most things for right-handed people because we just like to favor majorities. The same way that like we have entire whole ass cities that are just built like, hey, if you're disabled in this city, fuck you, sorry.
like being queer is just so trendy that like 40% of the youth homeless population is youth. Like, so, such an amazing trend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 40% is queer. Yeah, the youth homeless. Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot less than 40% that are queer, but 40% of the youth homeless population are queer because of parents being disapproving and kicking them out of the home.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So it's just this really cool, fun thing to do.
Yeah. So it's so quirky.
Yeah, but it's just like when they would say that, like, I can't account for this. I was yelling at my car, like, do you want to think about it for a second? Do you want to just like sit with it and just like think, what could it be? Because on the other side, I'm like, well, what do you think it is? Like, what do you think is causing it? And is your answer a social contagion, a dangerous social contagion? Is your answer that people are being infected by, you're calling like queerness and queer identities like an infection? Because that sounds, you're going to sound pretty like genocidal and fascistic and like eugenicistic, like pretty quickly. Like, I don't know if eugenicistic is a word, but I just invented it if it's not. But,
it's real now.
Yeah. but like, yeah, anyway, it's a frustrating and tedious debate to continue having, but I think it's important that those of us who still have stamina for it continue to engage. Natalie said at one point on that podcast, she was like, she was asked the same question, like, why do you engage with the debate? And she was like, well, I would like not to, but I feel like I have no choice. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you're not really leaving me much option. You're like saying you're going to like, I mean, there are people literally calling for the eradication of trans people. And it's like, so I don't really feel like I'm being left with much option, you know, most days.
Yeah, completely.
Other than to engage with it. Is there something, and it can be multiple things, but is there something that you wish with your advocacy, with your content about debates, with debating with people, and is there something that you are hoping to convey or hoping to help people to understand? I mean, I think we've covered a lot of it in this conversation, mm-hmm. but is there like something that people who don't know where they stand, who feel compelled by arguments about like trans women in sports or things, you know, is there something that you would like, that you hope to like convey to people who are still sort of stuck on whether or not they can get their, throw their full weight behind this movement?
Yeah, that's, I mean, at kind of just like a high level, I just wish that people would genuinely see the humanity of trans people as equal as the humanity of cisgender people. There are so many ways throughout the legal system, throughout the way in which we're treated socially, throughout the ways in which we're discriminated against, excluded, marginalized, bullied, that it's just clear that society at large does not see the humanity of trans people as the same as the humanity of cisgender people. And all of it is based in misunderstandings, ignorance, false assumptions, ideas that like trans people are delusional about their biology, or that they you know, have unrealistic dogmatic expectations. When I'm somebody out here who I'm very open and honest about the, you know, the full reality of all these situations, I think that it's very important for us to be, you know, honest about the truth about our biology and the truth about like how transsexual biology is unique and has changed in certain aspects, and how, you know, we just want our humanity recognized, and all of these ignorant attempts to disparage us, they're not going to look good in the history books. They simply won't.
I agree with you, and that's beautifully said. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk with me about this. I really, really appreciate it. It's great getting to just pick your brain a little bit, and just you speak so well on this topic, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing online and everything that you're doing to help clarify and elucidate the rationale in this position, you know, I think it's so hard to argue that like we're all going to be kicking ourselves in 10 or 20 years and going like, ah, fuck, we were wrong. Like, it's so hard to like imagine that like being on the side of like helping out just historically disenfranchised and marginalized and demonized people is like somehow going to backfire. So yeah, I appreciate the work that you're doing so much. you want to tell people where they can find you, where they can follow along?
Absolutely. And, well, thanks so much for having me on. It was my pleasure. I'm Nominal Naomi. You can just Google search Nominal Naomi, but the primary platforms you'll find me on are TikTok and Twitch and YouTube. I would love it if you checked out my content. I think that you would enjoy it if you enjoyed this episode, and hope to have you in the Nom Nom community.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And I'll see you out there on the old internet. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, so that's it. You know, smart person, that Nominal Naomi. Very smart and well-spoken. Thought that went really well. You see what I mean? You see what I mean, though? It's where it's like, you can get why a person would not want to debate the validity of their identity, but also we're in a situation where bigots, hard-hearted and hard-headed bigots are sort of forcing the issue, sort of forcing us to have this debate. And it's good that we have people like Naomi out there who are equipped to engage with the debate, both emotionally equipped and intellectually equipped. And I'm happy to stay on those front lines with Naomi as long as I have to. I truly do believe that we will continue to win in this debate and continue to see progress made. That's what I think. That's what I hope, but that's what I believe too. That's kind of it. All right. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or by going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. Can look me up on Spotify or Apple Music if you want to hear the tunes there. The vinyl, the double vinyl, it's oh my God, the vinyl is finally almost ready to be shipped out to the people who bought it. So thank you to the people who already bought it, and I'll have leftover copies if people want to buy it. I finally got some test pressings that worked, and I think we're actually finally getting that vinyl made. So that's cool. Patreon.com/AustinArcher if you want to support this show and the content that I make on other social media platforms. Yeah, dude. Yeah. Yeah. That's everything. Thank you so much. Love you so much. We'll see you next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Okay. Bye-bye.